Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by Robert Phillips. In 2012, Robert quit his job as CEO and president of Edelman, the largest PR firm in the world. Since then, he has called himself a recovering PR person and has written a number of books on the future of the industry and the challenges it faces. His latest book, Trust Me, PR is Dead, argues in the world of social media and radical transparency that there is now nowhere for big businesses to hide and so very little room for PR. Now an advisor to many of the world's largest firms, he's co-founder of Jericho Chambers, a visiting professor at Cass Business School and a columnist at the International Business Times. Robert, thank you for joining me.
It's great to be here.
So tell us, how did this journey start then? How did you go from, is it gamekeeper to poacher? I don't even know how to term it now.
A lot of people have asked me that question as to whether I had an epiphany. And I think
a Damascene conversion.
A Damascene conversion, a nice Jewish atheist with, yes, Damascene conversion. Or as one of my colleagues said, I wasn't the first Jewish radical to end up being crucified or something like
right.
that.
Good to be compared to Jesus. Yeah, I like
yeah,
the comparables.
Yeah, that's by George Pitcher, who I founded Jericho with, who happens to be an Anglican priest. But I guess that's another story.
Yeah.
So I think two things happened. I think there'd been a nagging doubt in my mind about the industry overall and about the way that everything was driven by consumerism and how PR was feeding that consumerism. And that doubt had been there for a long, long time. And for those who have followed stuff that I've written or where I've spoken, they'll know that I published Citizen Renaissance in 2007, 2008, which looked at how communications can be a force for reforming good rather than driving this sort of hedonistic treadmill on which we often find ourselves. And I wanted us to think in terms of citizenship, hence the title Citizen Renaissance, rather than in terms of consumption. So I think there's a slow burn, a slow nagging doubt in my mind that things were not quite right with the way the communications industry was structured. But then I did have an epiphany, and it's a story I tell in the book, and I was sitting on a park bench in Chicago with Richard Edelman, the global CEO of Edelman, the son of the founder, Dan Edelman. I was the president and CEO of the Europe, Middle East and African business, so I ran about 25% of the global firm. And I outlined to Richard some of the reasons that I felt that the industry was failing structurally. Its inability to scale, a shortage of talent, the fact that it supported hierarchies, not networks, the fact that it obsessed about outputs, not outcomes, and fundamentally that it didn't really understand data. And Richard agreed with me on nearly all of these issues, but said that it was too challenging, too expensive, too time-consuming to change the nature of the business, even though we were privately held and I controlled or ran 25% of it and he was the global CEO. It was that time, in a way, I sort of fell out of love with the industry that I spent 25, 30 years professing and just decided on the plane home that I had to quit and call it a day.
So is it the way that the PR industry is systemically set up to deliver, as it were, that you have a problem with? Or is it, I mean, because there are deeper challenges within the book about the nature of honesty, engaging, having a positive dialogue with people. I mean, it seems to be both, really, because, I mean, I work in PR and I would agree with your analysis. You know, people would rather do 10 days work in a month and then bill for that rather than, like, as you say, billing outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the challenges that I think the industry faces. It sells itself on being able to give counsel to the dreadfully named C-suite at chief executive level, but there are very few people who are actually skilled enough to do that. And so I think the industry has to come to terms with what it is and how it functions. And part of that is the structural difficulties that it has. I think a couple of things in direct answer to your question. One of the points I make in the book is that PR is not a profession. There is no entry, you know, there's no sanction on people who do bad PR. There is no entry qualification for setting up a PR business. I set up my first PR business at 21 and I have no qualifications in PR whatsoever.
I don't have any qualifications in PR at all.
So it's difficult to see PR as a profession. Dentistry is a profession. Law is a profession.
Architecture is a profession.
Architecture is a profession. PR is not. It is an industry. And one of the early interviewees in the book is the entrepreneur Luke Johnson. And he says to me, Robert, of course, PR is not dead because where there's a buyer, there's a market, and lots of clients are still buying PR. So as long as they continue to buy, the industry will survive for some time yet. So what I wanted to do with the book, and we should probably talk about it, the book was not in my head when I left Edelman. I didn't leave Edelman either to set up Jericho Chambers or to write a book about trust and the end of the PR industry. But I did want to make the point that PR is not a profession, that the industry will die on its feet if it doesn't radically change the way that it goes about things. And one of the things that's been very interesting over the past sort of 18 months of this project is how people have responded to that. Some have responded very defensively. Some have responded only from economic terms. We make loads of money, so PR's not dead. But that's not really the point I was trying to make. And the point I really wanted to make, which you alluded to, was that in the world in which we live, we have to take a more radical approach to honesty, a more radical approach to transparency. We have to understand the chaotic order of things and how we can embrace that chaos. We have to understand how decisions are better made through crowds. We have to stop trying to impose our point of view and instead negotiate a future. There are all sorts of things that really I wanted to surface. And I wanted to surface them partly because I felt that communications have been part of the trust problem, which everyone talked about, and partly because I didn't think that PR is part of the trust solution. And it's the relationship, if you like, between PR and trust that I really wanted to explore. Some people have over-focused or over-obsessed about the PR is dead bit without realizing that it's matched to the trust me bit of the title.
You make two very interesting points there, and I think I'd like to focus on the industry side first before we start to talk on the communications challenge, because I think both of them are worth exploring in detail. In terms of the first point, you say PR is not a profession, but do you think it should be? I mean, do you think people should gain, you know, qualifications, and that the CIPR and the PRCA should have greater powers of censure? Because that would actually mean that the industry would regulate itself more and be more robust, and that might help the industry overall. I mean, it's a cliche to say it, but many people say that the PR industry has dreadful PR.
The PR industry does have dreadful PR, and that's partly because there is an ill definition around public relations, and partly because you have certain practitioners who lead the industry astray, if you like, and there's lots of evidence to support that. I'm not sure that regulation is the answer. One of the themes that I explore in the book, not in terms of the PR sector, but in terms of business generally, is this over-obsession with measurement, over-obsession with compliance, over-obsession with ticking all the boxes, rather than asking the question, are we doing what is right? And obviously, you know, you see it with the banking crisis, or you saw it with the banking crisis, you've just seen it with Volkswagen on a humongous scale. And so I worry that we've made ourselves so regulated as a society, so obsessed about metrics as a society, that we've forgotten how to make better judgment, how to do the right thing. And I think that we live in a business culture that is way too much dominated by lawyers that are trying to de-risk stuff, but actually increasing the risk by de-risking it from a reputational point of view quite often, and PR people who are trying to craft the message, land the narrative, shape the story. This is nonsense. No one can manage the message any longer. The world isn't like that. The world is far more asymmetrical. And we need to think like an insurgent. We need to think like an activist. We have to think asymmetrically if we're to communicate effectively in a changed world.
Isn't the problem, though, that most kind of mid to large agencies are a bit like the huge oil tanker, that it just takes a long time to steer them away? And in a sense, they're geared up like a sausage factory, aren't they? You know, you win a client, you're in competition with maybe 10 other agencies, and it'll be, say, $5,000 a month. So you're never going to get the top people that can afford to do that. So you're going to hand it to an enthusiastic graduate who's got buckets of enthusiasm and intellect but lacks the experience. And in a sense, that's the way the whole PR industry works, on that kind of throughput-oriented box-ticking culture rather than, as you say, genuine counsel.
And it's made worse by the fact that, A, there's not enough talent coming into the market that allows them to build that genuine counsel. But the point you make is a very important one. It's not actually just a problem of the PR sector. It's a problem of most professional services firms. What they end up doing is building a bureaucracy. And in order to feed the bureaucracy, you have to make money out of the bureaucracy. You have to make money out of the senior account managers, the account executives. So the senior people are out there winning the business, winning the business, winning the business. And then the middle level people are servicing the business, servicing the business, servicing the business. And that's actually why you get an awful lot of very stressed, very young people working in professional services firms. You see it especially in management consultancy. I've just come back from a short lecture tour talking to future leadership people. Of FTSE 100 companies, and their management consultants, they acknowledge that they've got the juniors working on the business who are working 80 hours a week, where the senior partners are coming in and not even giving the best advice, because they're not even close enough to the advice that's being given. And I think PR is that writ large. It's made worse, by the way, by the over-dominance of the large network organisations like WPP or Omnicom or Interpublic, which is all about scale. Mm. It's all about scale and profitability. And to Edelman's absolute credit, it was never about scale and profitability. It was always actually about doing the right thing and doing a decent job. And, you know, and I've gone out of my way to say it in the book and in interviews, and I'll say it again here. I really think that Edelman are the good guys within the industry. But I believe they are now of a size where they are challenged by exactly the same problems because they have mouths to feed, and you only feed mouths one way, which is by driving revenues. And by driving revenues, sometimes the client comes second, not first. And that's fine, except when you sell yourself on always putting the client first, and that's problematic from a trust point of view. And also from a best advice point of view, don't say that you've got people who are skilled at giving C-suite advice when they're basically 4, 5, 6 years out of college. Doesn't make any sense.
This, in a sense, is a controversial question, but do you not think that the world of business gets the PR consultancy and the PR advice that it deserves, insofar as it might be controversial, to play devil's advocate for a second, to blame the customer and the client? But I know many people who do media training, for example, and they often say to me, actually, I could do media training in 2 hours, you know, an hour of theory and then an hour of practice to boost their confidence. But the buyer doesn't want 2 hours media training. They want to buy a day's media training. And if I say we can do it in 2 hours, even though that's the correct advice, the buyer at that point thinks that I'm not offering a quality service because I'm not the same as everyone else. So sometimes the supply has to kind of fit in with the perceived metrics of the buyer. And yes, it would be an honest supply that says, actually, you don't need to do it like that. But on the other hand, it might be someone who has an empty order book.
I mean, you're right. There's a culture shift in the client consultancy relationship. And I think that is problematic. And bear in mind also that certainly a lot of clients come out of agency land, so they're sort of bred in a certain way, so they expect a certain way. You never break out of it, and it's the same problem you
it's
have.
It's kind of polluted the whole well, hasn't it? Buyer and seller.
And you see that in much the same way that you have non-executive directors who are just drawn from the same pool of non-executive directors, and then the world wonders why it has a diversity problem in business. But I guess that's for another conversation. Traditional consultancy, whether it is in PR or any other area, likes to build client dependency. That's the model on which they work. They want the client to need you so much that they can never walk away. The way that we think, as Jericho Chambers, in so much we have a shared philosophy, is that it must be about building capacity, not dependency, within the client organization. It's much better to help a client succeed or help a client thrive than it is to make them dependent on you. I don't think that the retainer relationship is healthy in any way, shape or form, because what it does actually is it drives lots of people to turn out lots of pointless PowerPoint or lots of bullshit platitudes in order to satisfy some sort of client's internal justification of whether it's worth paying X grand a month to their consultancy. So I think you actually have to break that dependency culture. The second thing is, which we always talk about, is about talking truth to power. And that means being able to be comfortable to have a conversation that says, I'm not going to do that piece of media training and charge you 8 hours for it because it's only going to take me 2 hours. And funnily enough, when you work within a network of senior people, as we do at Jericho, you can get to the answer much faster. So it doesn't take you 8 hours, it does take you 2 hours, and you don't have to pay for the bureaucracy that comes with it. So actually, it's, I suppose, more cost-effective anyway. And the trouble with the PR industry is it says it talks truth to power, but mostly talks truth to marzipan, and that needs to be changed.
How do you build trust at the beginning then? Because I would be interested by this. I mean, I've been in PR well over 15 years, and I've always found that the traditional start of a relationship is a client says that they've been hurt before, they've been let down by two or three agencies or whatever, and because of that, trust is low. And they tend to focus on metrics, as you've said. For the first couple of months, they say, look, we want X number of press releases, or we want this, and it's all about measurability. Yeah. But after about 6 to 8 weeks, they stop asking those questions because they can see you're capable, they trust you. Yeah. But it's not there at the beginning. So how do you, if the trust is not innately deserved at that first moment, how do you earn it credibly?
Well, one of the points that some of the detractors from the book have missed is the irony in the title, Trust Me, PR is Dead. Of course, you shouldn't trust me. I'm a repentant spinner, as management today called me. So there's no reason to trust me. And there are lots of sectors, politics is one, PR is another, I guess a state agency is a third, which have always had very low levels of trust. And we can come on to talk about the trust dimension, but this aim of having more trust is pretty much a nonsense aim. What we should be looking at is greater trustworthiness in relationships. And trustworthiness is based on a slightly different system, if you like. It's based on honesty, it's based on competency, it's based on reliability. That's what makes someone trustworthy at a base level. But above all, people become trustworthy if they make themselves reciprocally vulnerable to one another. So if, you know, in the old cliche, they both have skin in the game, it's a terrible phrase. But if they know that there is no absolute power on either side of the relationship, they're forced into a situation. And we do this now with clients. This is part of the sort of core journey that we take people on, which is to demonstrate that by having having reciprocal vulnerability, mutual respect for one another, and actually being able to, the phrase we use in some of the talks we give is about standing naked in front of one another. That's what builds real trustworthiness and real trust. And so part of the problem is that client says to prospective agency, I've got a problem. The consultancy, because it's so desperate to win the business, doesn't really interrogate that problem to any significant degree. Goes, yep, that's a problem we can deal with, and then rushes off. And by not asking the right question, and usually the bigger question at the right time, they're starting off in exactly the wrong place. So I think one of the most important things in building a proper trustworthy relationship, going back to honesty, competency, reliability, and reciprocal vulnerability, is being able to see what the question really is and to not be afraid to ask the bigger question and to take the relationship forward from that point. What then happens is that, oh, you want measurement? You know, want measurement through AVE? Well, we don't believe in AVE, but we'll give you some advertising value equivalents anyway. Okay, you want to know that more people have had the opportunity to see this particular campaign? We'll give you that measurement. These are all bullshit measurements, right? So,
and of course, with social media, we're even more dependent on metrics now, because I can say 812 people have read your tweet.
Yes, you can say 812 people, though whether 812 people could give a toss about your tweet is another point. But I think that my views have really become much more militant on this over the past 18 months of the project, which is that measurement is the wrong question. Accountability is the right question. So it's how do you as an organization, even as a consultancy, make yourself accountable to your client? How do you co-produce what it is you want to deliver with that client, or if you're a corporation or brand, with your customers, with your employees? How do you co-produce your leadership, your ideas, your manifesto, and how do you make yourself accountable to them on an ongoing basis? And that completely shifts the nature of business, because that accountability, as I argue in the book, should be rooted in the common good. Doing it is what is right for the many, not what is right for the few. Speaking to the 99%, not the 1%. And rooting that, if you go back through the history of time and look at what common good means, so some of the more foundation principles of justice and tolerance and courage and wisdom and virtue, this is what makes for good companies, for good organizations, for good employers, for more customer-focused organizations. So it's not complicated. It's about understanding the common good, rooting what you do in doing the right thing for the common good, and being held accountable to it and making yourself accountable to it.
I'm not an anarcho-communist by any means, but isn't the problem here, or what I seem to be hearing is the deeper problem in what you're saying, is capitalism itself here? So straight away, if you charge a client for advice, in a sense, there's a conflict of interest, because although you might be giving what you consider to be the best advice, there's also a conflict because you want to be the person that delivers it. Also, you mentioned about having a relationship with a client that builds capacity and not dependence, which is great. But of course, no one would want to invest in a PR business that wants to take a client and then earn itself out of the relationship 2 or 3 years later. If you look at the way that capitalism is set up at the moment, the way capital moves, if I'm a long-term investor in a traditional type PR agency, I want them to encourage that dependency, because if you're going to leave after 3 years, we're going to be pouring water into a kind of sales funnel that's got a leak in the bottom.
No, I think you're looking at it the wrong way around. I think what you have to do is that same vulnerability on the projects and campaigns that you work with. And by the way, I don't think that the PR consultancy model works necessarily for this, but I think that there is a new model that emerges from it, which is built around the same principles that an agency or consultancy would apply to a client organization, which is on this basis of reciprocal vulnerability and mutuality. And it's fascinating, the number of businesses, and we'll come on to talk about capitalism in a minute, but a number of businesses who say they believe in mutuality and they love the John Lewis, you know, partnership as a great example of a mutualized organization. And they sod all in their own working practices to reform themselves on that basis. And that goes actually to the heart of the trust issue. Trust is not a message. Trust is an outcome. It's based on what you do, not what you say. And too many consultancies, and especially PR firms, sell a merchandise trust as a message. But the point is this, is that if you invest in a program, and I can talk about some of the work, for example, that we've done with KPMG on responsible tax for the common good, it's a live program. if you invest in a program as a consultant, you should have as much vested interest in the success of the program. You should have as much stake for your reputation as the client has for their reputation. And when we embarked on the responsible tax program with KPMG, the person who's now the European head of tax, Jane McCormack, you know, she will now reflect on it and say, it was a very scary thing that we were doing, but we knew it was the right thing to do. And as a consultant, for us, it's a great theory, but stepping into that and advising a large corporate to go on this journey with us, it was a very scary thing for us to do as well. We probably didn't, you know, surface that at the time. So that sort of vulnerability was there together. And that's what I mean about going on the journey together. I don't mean about going in there and getting out of your sales funnel as quickly as possible. I mean quite the opposite. However, I don't believe in long-term retained relationships because I think it leads to bad practice. But to your point or your question earlier, most of the network agencies, you came back and said, we've won a project. Then the CEO goes, well, that's all right. Come back and say you want a retained relationship, and they're thrilled because it guarantees cash flow and certainty of income. But again, it's the wrong question to be asking. In answer to your capitalism question, and some people call me an anti-capitalist, I'm not an anti-capitalist, and I absolutely believe in profit. I don't believe in profit as everything. I've spoken out quite vehemently against what I see as the profit maximizers, and I think we have to draw a distinction between those who understand profit optimization and profit maximization. And you can look at that as a distinction between putting the primacy of shareholder value versus understanding there is a universe of stakeholders out there. And lots of people hide behind, you know, this sort of nonsense Milton Friedman thing about the social responsibility of businesses' profit, and say, well, actually, that's what we, you know, we're empowered to do as business owners. Actually, if you look at the Companies Act, I think it's Section 172, it will tell you that businesses have to operate in the interests of all their stakeholders, all their communities, all their employees. So I don't believe in shareholder primacy, and I don't believe in profit maximization. That does not make me an anti-capitalist. And many people, far more qualified than I am, have written plenty of books on the reform of capitalism, and I think it's needed. And part of my beef, if you like, with the PR industry is it's propping up a clapped out old model of capitalism, which actually needs to be exposed. And the reason it needs to be exposed is not because I'm calling for its downfall. I'm calling for its reform. And if we don't reform it, worse things are going to happen if we don't start making the changes ourselves. And you say you've been a lifelong member of the Labour Party, or 20 years active in the Labour Party. I was, you know, I started my political career in the Social Democrats, and I joined the Labour Party, and I resigned last summer because I couldn't stand Ed Miliband any longer. And yes, I am of the left. But
I wish I'd had the balls to do that myself, actually. But I admire and envy you for having the courage.
Yeah, he never wrote back when I wrote to him and told him.
A lot of my friends resigned the day Jeremy got elected, sadly.
Yeah. Well, I think Corbyn is an interesting phenomenon, and Corbyn actually demonstrates the characteristics of public leadership that I call for in my book. So in the book, we talk about a new model of leadership which replaces public relations. We call it public leadership, and that is based on being activist, citizen-centric, co-produced, and society-first. And old Jezza ticks all those boxes. It's quite terrifying that when you write something in theory and the answer is Jeremy Corbyn, you realise maybe what you've done. He's also taught, in the book I write about the need for public value, public leadership, public value. Public value is about accountability. And of course, there he is with his versions of, you know, people's Q&A at Prime Minister's Question Time.
And also being honest in interviews, stuff. Actually, you know, would you ever press the nuclear button? No, I wouldn't. I mean, because in a sense, these are the questions that you can't ever win. And yet he did. He just simply told the truth.
Yeah, I think
I have to admire him for that.
Well, I admire him to a point, but because I believe that fundamentally he's wrong and misguided, I don't admire him that much. But
ironically, I actually think Trident should be abolished. I agree with him on some issues. I just don't think he's the guy to do it because people he doesn't look prime ministerial.
Well, Corbyn is interesting. And I think that if you go back to this trust question, he sits on the horns of a delicious trust dilemma, because what won it for Jezza in 2015 within the Labour Party will not win it for Labour in 2020. So something's got to give. Either his honesty has got to give or his authenticity has got to give. And if you're going to be a trusted leader, a modern public leader, you have to be both honest and authentic. And I don't believe that the public will tolerate the authenticity, if you like, the honesty of him saying, no, I wouldn't press the nuclear button.
It also depends on what you mean by honesty, because if he's a leader, you know, 3 or 4 years from now, and he honestly believes that for whatever reason, rightly or wrongly, that the public won't vote him in, and therefore he concludes he's a liability, then he ought ethically to stand down. But of course, many political people don't do that because they've spent their entire careers building up to that point, and they always have to be pushed rather than stand down.
And I think that was one of the early signs that all will not be as everyone thought with Jeremy. When I think probably 10 days in, and somebody said, well, could you see yourself as Prime Minister? And the answer, the honest answer would have been, well, let's see where I get to in a couple of years, or if I've shifted the debate to the left, or I've brought, you know, big issues like austerity to the fore, my job may well be done. That would have been the honest answer.
A disruptor.
Yeah, which is fine. And you know, I argue in the book that constant disruption is a great thing in leadership. But he didn't say that. He said, of course I can consider myself Prime Minister. And of course, by then he was being groomed. And again, there is a wonderful irony in that, that the party that condemned itself over spinning is now desperate to spin Jeremy.
I want to go back to the reputation issue because I find that genuinely fascinating, and I'd be interested in your take. But you've hinted there about the PR industry has to change. I mean, clearly there's tons of vested interests to keep it carrying on as it currently is. Mm. What's next for the PR industry? Will it collapse as it is? I mean, is it the Titanic that is going to hit the iceberg and something has to be done? Or do you think it will hit the iceberg, sink, and then I'm mixing my metaphors here, but that might be a good thing for the industry because it could allow it the opportunity to start again.
Just to chuck another metaphor in. Which is the one I use in the book. I think it's sleepwalking over a cliff. And it's only really a question of time before that cliff appears.
I prefer my Titanic analogy, but I was thinking, how could it unsink? So, we'll use yours.
Part of the problem is that there are an awful lot of people who lead the industry, and this probably won't win me any more friends, who are pale, male and stale.
Can I declare an interest as someone who is pale, male and somewhat stale?
As am I, but are leading an industry and thinking that actually they'll be out of it before the cliff appears and they would have made their money and would have got out. And in the book, I call for a generational shift in leadership, and I'd very much like to see the leadership of the PR industry and indeed the leadership of other industries skip an entire generation and stop pale, male and stale leaders who are 50-something handing on to pale, male and stale leaders who are 40-something. There needs to be a complete rethink about diversity, and I don't just mean gender diversity, I mean age diversity, disability diversity, bringing more minority communities into leadership roles in the industry to really change the nature of how we lead. Because I don't believe this generation of leaders is taking us anywhere. And again, this is not a point just about the PR industry. You can look at it for industry as a whole. I was at a leadership conference for future leaders. There were 22 men and 3 women in the room. It's absolutely terrifying. I presented at the European Roundtable a couple of years ago, which is the CEOs of the 50 largest manufacturing companies in Europe. It's a story I tell in the book. The title of my presentation was "You're No Longer in Control, Get Over It." That went down well. And there were 43 men and 1 woman present.
Incredible.
This is absolutely hideous. Mm. And we need to look at ourselves both as a PR industry that I think is shameful about the way that it approaches diversity. And that's why Tanya Joseph and I set up the original PRCA Diversity Network. But I think that there is a much wider problem about diversity in business overall, and that speaks to some of the problems we have in leadership. But back to your reputation question, how do you measure reputation?
Because you've got these awful algorithms that are useless, or you've got the fact that you could ask 20 people about me that wouldn't like me, and a different 20 people would say I'm the greatest thing since sliced bread.
That's always how the advertising industry survived for so long. It created focus groups that agreed with themselves and then sold that back to clients. Absolutely hideous. And that's why in the book, I talk about new systems of public value that's rooted in wise crowds, mixing crowds of stakeholders, employees, customers, regulators, politicians, media, and actually testing your ideas, testing your theories with those crowds and making yourself accountable to those crowds. And let them decide whether you're to be trusted or whether you're trustworthy. Let them decide whether your reputation sucks or not. You know, it's not really – and this is – runs the heart of everything that I've been thinking and writing about, which is we don't live any longer in an age of command and control. It's over, right? Get over it. No one is in control any longer. The result is chaotic. So all you can do is embrace the chaos. And actually, rather than having a sort of very controlled, rather linear approach to stakeholders, throw them all in together, bring dissenting voices into the argument, listen to people who really don't like you and really don't agree with you, and then you can learn from what you listen to. And that is fundamentally important. But the whole communications industry is about control, control, control. To use one phrase, it's always looking for happy endings. Those happy endings don't exist. The real world doesn't work like that. So get over it. We live in a world of Edward Snowden, not in a world of Edward Bernays.
But even in the kind of hallowed days of Blairism, you know, he showed strong leadership on certain issues, but he had Philip Gould in the background running these focus groups, talking to statistically significant representative samples of people, saying, what do you want the Prime Minister to do? So in a sense, he had an ear to the wider populace through focus groups run by Philip Gould. Do you think that that was a strong element of his leadership, or do you think that undermined him?
I'm not arguing against insight. Jericho Chambers was founded by three of us, myself, George Pitcher, the Anglican priest and journalist, and Christine Armstrong. And Christine's background is in human insights and is the reminder to the whole organisation that we have to put humanity at the heart of everything that we do, and that humanity is driven by insight. I mean, I think it's one of the problems of data, that you can have the systems, but you also need the empathy. And it's the systems and empathy working together that makes the insights more powerful. But listening to real people is where it's at. My point about crowds, though, is that you can actually get better statistical relevance from crowds of wise people. That's a great statistic than on who wants to be a millionaire. If you ask the audience, you have a 91% chance of getting the answer right. And so I think we need to rethink how we go about garnering those insights. But the point about crowds is not just about the insights, it's about the accountability. So it makes it an ongoing process. And that's the point I was trying to make earlier about what modern corporations can do is to create safe spaces for these sometimes very difficult arguments to flourish. You know, I talked about the work we're doing on tax. We're doing another project around the future of work. We're doing one around affordability. We're doing one around housing. These are really difficult issues. Mm. And actually, there is no right or wrong answer. Now, in a world of sterile measurement, of course, there's always a right or wrong answer, but it's not really truthful. It's not honest. And it doesn't make the organisation accountable to its stakeholders. And I think that reciprocal vulnerability I talked about comes out of a crowd-based approach.
I think there's a societal issue that we can talk about in a second, because I do think this trust issue is incredibly important and we need to go into it. But just kind of last question on the industry. How long do you think it's going to take the industry to steer this vast tanker, as it were, and react to this societal change? Because as you say, many people in the industry, including me, would say that it's not fit for purpose at the moment. But on the other hand, we've got all these systemic problems, this infrastructure that's set up. I mean, in a sense, that I feel the current PR industry is a solution to a problem that is 30 years old. And it's not the current system that we have now. But, you know, how long do you think it'll take to steer the ship?
I mean, I don't know the answer to that question. It could be the PR industry is Blockbuster to someone else's Netflix. It could be, you know, a Kodak to someone else's digital revolution. So it's impossible to tell in this age of, you know, where change is never going to be this slow again. Who only knows what tomorrow holds? Of course, at the moment, there are an awful lot of people throwing bucket loads of money at the PR industry, and the PR industry is lapping it up. One of the big beats I had quite a difficult review of my book in the Financial Times. And
I read it. Wasn't the reviewer really young?
Well, that was quite interesting. Yeah. Well, it wasn't so much that he was young. As a 50-something, he was a 30-something. Or is a 30-something?
I thought he was younger than that, but anyway.
But he sort of said he thought I was naive about business, which coming from someone
was the line.
Coming from someone who's got two Oxbridge degrees and worked at the FT for 12 years since leaving university, I'd love to know exactly what his frontline
business
is.
He might be right, of course.
Yeah, and actually a certain naivety may not be a bad thing. But my bigger issue with that review, and I'm glad he wrote it because actually it undermined his argument much more than it undermined mine. He said, well, the point is, if Thomas Cook had better PR, it wouldn't be in the mess it was in. That was immediately after the scandal at Thomas Cook for taking the money from the hotel operator and hiding it from the parents.
The carbon monoxide emissions that killed that poor family's children.
That's right. And that's absolute nonsense. What happened at Thomas Cook was, as indeed what happened at Volkswagen, a failure in communications. It wasn't about bad PR. It was an epic, substantive failure in the way that they behaved. Mm-hmm. And if you go to the heart of the trust issue, it's very, very simple, apart from saying that trust is not a message, it's an outcome. You know, it's about what you do, not about what you say. Mm-hmm. So no amount of PR could or should have saved Thomas Cook. And one of the things I find most bizarre and annoying is that what has Thomas Cook done? It's announced it's restructuring its PR department in response to what happened
when
recently.
When PR wasn't the problem.
This is an absolute disgrace.
PR was the symptom.
Absolutely. And it should be called as an absolute disgrace.
I always say to clients, if they don't want to be in tomorrow's newspaper for clubbing baby seals to death,
don't club them to death.
It's as simple as that, really. And I don't know about you, but I hate that word C-suite, but I have a lot of CEO clients, and I find that they're often asking me about reputational issues, yeah. Whereas really it's more of a business issue why are you doing this?
Two thoughts on that. I mean, you're absolutely right. One, the thunderbolts that struck me. I left Edelman at the end of 2012. I didn't have a job to go to. I had a book idea in my mind, but it wasn't this book. It was a book about business states. But one of the things that struck me in the few weeks and months afterwards is that quite often things that are set up as communications problems are not communications problems at all.
Agreed.
They're business problems. Mm. There may be problems with organizational design. There may be problems with talent. There may be problems with technology. There may be problems with product. But too often, and maybe this is the fault of Blairism, much as I lament his passing, is that we see every problem as a communications problem. And going back to your very first question, what then happens is there's a bunch of consultancies who dive in to recognise it as a conveniently recognise it as a communications problem and try and use a communication solution on a problem that's not a communications problem in the first instance.
So use a recyclable club on the seal and
I'll come on to seal clubbing in a moment. Was it Michael Heseltine who described John Pressker as the man who had the look of a man who clubbed seals for a living?
I think
it was. Anyway.
I always liked William Hague's bar, but Tony Blair in PMQs, and he said, I'm not going to take any transport lectures from a PM whose deputy's idea of a park and ride scheme is to park one Jaguar and ride away in another. I really like that.
Yeah, we were talking actually at the weekend at a Labour Party conference about two Jags and about whether it was all about Pauline's hair, but I guess that's
Pauline's a ledge.
Yeah.
She's brilliant.
Absolutely another story. So communications problems are not communication solutions, but one of the things that I was determined to do in setting up Jericho was about having real expertise to solve problems. And that's why if you have a problem that is an organisational design problem, have a partner who's an expert in organisational design. If you've got a problem in product innovation, have a partner who's an expert in product innovation. And don't try and sort of paint everything with this communication sort of fits all and saves all brush, because it doesn't work. And it may increase the dependency, which is the conversation we're having earlier, but it's not about building either the capacity or having the right answer. The other thing I'd say about clubbing seals is this. I think it's okay to be an arsehole. I say it in the book. There's a chapter called It's Okay to Be an Arsehole. It's sort of dedicated to the bankers. What I have a problem with is the bankers that want to be go out and say they want to be trusted, ethical and good, but then behave like an arsehole.
Mm.
So don't say one thing and do another. It's just about honesty.
So what
honesty
would you
with yourself as much as anything else.
Just say, where the bankers will clear your cheque 3 days quicker than you'd like, and yeah, we are arseholes, but just get over it.
Well, it's not so much that. I mean, I did an exercise, a client, which is a story I tell in the book about the CEO of a bank who told me that he was institutionally blind on an industrial scale, which I thought was very nice because it was a nice piece of self-awareness. And I did a piece of work for him about being an ethical, good and trusted bank. And I went back to him with 10 principles and 10 behaviours he had to do. As we went through this list of 10, I won't give you all 10, I'll give you a couple just as an example. The first principle is transparency. So I absolutely believe you're right, Robert, transparency. We want to be transparent. And I said, great, so abolish free banking. And he said, why? And I said, because it's not free.
Nothing's free if you pay too much.
Somebody has to pay somewhere, and therefore it's not transparent. So you may believe in the principle of transparency, but abolish free banking. So we can't do that. We make too much money. So he wouldn't enact the behaviour that went with the principle. The second principle was about mutuality. And here was a man who constantly went on and on about the John Lewis partnership as being his model organisation. And so I said, well, if you believe in mutuality, let's take some of the shares in the bank and give them to the employees, make them, have a stake in the firm. We can't do that.
Exactly. It's the talk, but they're not walking the walk.
That's right. So the second principle, mutuality, failed on the behaviour, which is share ownership. The third principle, I think, was proportionality. So, absolutely, everything needs to be kept in proportion. Great. Abolish bankers' bonuses. They're not proportionate to the frontline staff.
No, they're not.
Well, we can't do that. Flight of talent, all that. So we went through these 10 principles and 10 behaviours. He agreed with every single principle.
But then wouldn't change his behaviour.
Not change a single behaviour. And at the end of that, he said, well, that's been absolutely fantastic. Really looking forward to working with you. And I said, I'm sorry, I'm not going to take your money, and walked away. But I think that's sort of what gave rise to the idea it's okay to be an arsehole. If he said, look, we make too much money out of so-called free banking. It's the way that we win accounts. Then so be it. But don't go around saying you want to be ethical, trusted and good if you're not prepared to live by those same mantras.
So I've got two questions, really. I'll ask them both, because in a sense they're separate, but in another way they're linked. So what do you think's caused this breakdown in trust overall? Because it's easier to say, you know, disconnection from the political process, social media enabling people to connect directly with the CEOs and challenge people in a way more robustly than they used to do. But also, what can be done? Because if you take your banking client, in a sense, don't you have the prisoner's dilemma? You know, the old philosophical conundrum where you stick two prisoners in separate cells and the first one to confess gets off. Yeah. But if neither of them confess, then both of them will get off. Yeah. And isn't the problem with your banking client that, in a sense, you can't blame him, because if he's the first mover in that industry, the disruptor, he's the one that's going to suffer financially, and then all of the other industry, they will follow suit, but they won't take the personal financial hit. So in a sense, everyone, in a sense, is utterly incapacitated because they can't be the first mover because they'll go bankrupt.
Well, I'm not sure about that. If someone said, you know, Paul Polman was going to suffer financially over moving Unilever to the Unilever Sustainable Living Plan, they might have thought he's mad, but it's kind of working. And to your question on reputation, his reputation and the reputation of Unilever is soaring as a result. And I'm not sure that Polman gets everything right. As I say in my book, I think there may be two Paul Polmans, but he's doing more that is right than is wrong. So, and he has been a big first mover. If you say that to Yvon Chouinard, who is the founder of Patagonia, when he sort of said, do not buy this jacket, and move Patagonia to a fully sustainable B Corporation, you know, that was the first mover in an industry, and he has led that industry, and others, including North Face, have been forced to follow. So I don't buy that, you know, by being a disruptor, you necessarily be disadvantaged. What I do think that says is that people are terrified of risk, and we live in this, it goes back to the point we're making earlier, we live in this incredibly risk-averse culture where we're surrounded by lawyers and PR people, and that's probably why Thomas Cook ended up in the mess that it did. And I think, and maybe this is the next book that I need to write, there is an inversely proportional relationship between risk and trust. And I would argue, anecdotally, because I haven't got the data to support it, that those that are more prepared to embrace risk actually are more trustworthy than those who try and mitigate risk the whole time because they try and fence it in. But back to your question about, you know, how do we get here? One of the things about the whole Trust Me, PR is Dead Journey, it's been fascinating, we decided to abandon the original publisher and go with a crowdfunding publishing platform, mainly because the original publisher, one of the big publishing houses, was like living and working in the 18th century.
Yeah.
And also we were going to live by this principle of being believers in the crowd, and hat tip to my friend Jim Woods.
My wife's an author, actually, and right. You know, the traditional publishing route is frankly dead.
Yes, well, the last chapter in the book is, what we did was we invited other voices into the book, and we held conversations with people, and they got to be heard as part of the crowdfunding process. And we have 9 wise crowd contributors, one of whom is Jim Woods, who runs an organization called The Crowd, and one of whom is my publisher, Dan Kieran, who has written a piece called Publishing is Dead as well. It closes the book. In the course of writing it, I wrote a blog about Trust Me, PR is Dead, and I got this response back from a guy called Tom Fletcher, who I hadn't met, still haven't met, though we exchange a lot of emails. Tom turns out to be Her Majesty's ambassador to Lebanon. He's actually just finished a tour of duty there, and he's back in the UK.
He wrote an amazing blog, didn't he?
He did, The Naked Diplomat.
Yes, absolutely.
That's absolutely right.
I remember that.
So Tom writes as The Naked Diplomat. If you haven't read his valedictory letter to Lebanon, it's one of the most beautiful pieces of writing.
I have a Lebanese client, actually, yeah. And he forwarded me it and said, this sums up, you know, how beautiful my country is and also what a nightmare it can be.
That's absolutely right. And it's an exquisite piece of writing. And Tom, I hope you're listening. But Tom wrote a blog in which he said, well, if PR is dead, diplomacy is certainly dead too. And I tell this as a metaphor or analogy for why the industry, the PR industry, got to this point. And he said, you know, diplomacy is just like PR, but it was born in 1815 in an age of monarchies and great states. And much of its sort of form, summits, communiques, are just nonsense. They don't make any sense in the world in which we live in. They're just sort of meaningless platitudes. He said, and he went on to write, let's be honest, post Julian Assange and Edward Snowden, we're much less trusted than we were. And what we need is a much more insurgent, much more activist, much more citizen-centric style of diplomacy. And he was echoing exactly the words that I wrote in my book. So I think there is this point that you know, I think PR is living in the wrong century. The PR industry is living in the wrong century because it's still trying to be controlling in an age of activism. it's still trying to, even though it sort of says ostensibly it brings other voices into the conversation, it doesn't bring the really challenging voices into the conversation that's really going to make a difference. And there are lots of examples of this in the diplomatic sector, and there are lots of different examples of this in the military sector as well. The Joint Special Forces Command in Iraq very famously decided to take a much more activist and insurgent approach the way that they went about their warfare, because if you have an asymmetrical enemy, you cannot fight them with a symmetrical system.
Absolutely.
And that is part of the problem. The world is now asymmetrical. Get over it. And don't try and find symmetrical solutions for asymmetrical problems, because they won't work.
I agree with your assessment, and I think it's radical and very, very timely. But in a sense, my next question is deliberately quite vague and quite open, which is what's to be done? I mean, say if you were having dinner with the Prime Minister and he said, and it was just a one-to-one, he said, you know, look,
sure Robert... I wasn't eating pork or pig's head.
Yeah, well, indeed. Yeah. But if he said, look, Robert, what, you know, what would you do then? I want to help you. Give me three or four very specific things that I can do, that I can set about some change in society. Or would you even say, actually, the whole parliamentary system's, as you say, a symmetric system, and in fact it's not the Prime Minister's duty to
well,
to
there's
do this.
There's another chapter in the book written by one of the crowd, which is Neil Lawson, who chairs the Good Society
Compass.
Press Group Compass,
yep.
And is one of my colleagues at Jericho Chambers. Everyone at Jericho has other lives, very important, because again,
I know
it's
Neil.
About bringing in again a plurality of voice and opinion, and not thinking that everyone is just some sort of agency flunky that can just sort of turn out PowerPoints and sales spiel.
It's quite a collective you've got going on, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And watch the space, because we're about to go from 14 partners to 18 partners. We've got some really exciting new people joining us, again, with a great diversity of opinion. But Neil wrote, politics is dead. And interestingly, I mean, the book project started in the spring of 2013, and much of the stuff that was predicted, that I predicted in the book, has now... You know, the death of party politics has sort of really been brought to life by what's happened with Corbyn, what happened with the coalition, what happened with the SNP, what's happening in America with Donald Trump, what happened with Tsipras and in Greece, what's happening in Spain with Podemos, even what's happening in Sweden with the New Democrats. It doesn't really matter whether it's right or left. There is to use one of Neil's phrases, there's something that's forcing a breakthrough in the permafrost of policy that's inhibited us. So I think that this change was always going to happen in politics as well. Yes, I think the parliamentary model here is completely broken. I've argued this for as long as I've been involved in or around politics. I think it stems back to a ridiculous non-proportional system of government. I argued for proportional representation long before it became, you know, refashionable in time in the coalition.
I'm a huge supporter, and I declare an interest. I'm a member of the Electoral Reform Society as well, of course.
Good. And a Republican, as I am too.
Indeed.
Republican in terms of getting rid of the monarchy, because I think a lot of the problem stems... from being subjects, not citizens.
Of course. Well, we need an elected and accountable head of state, yeah. One we can get rid of if we don't like them.
There's a story in the book where I did try and run a campaign to bring down the monarchy and worked for a campaign.
I would have supported you on that.
Yeah, and it is important, and I think it does pollute society because of the hereditary principle, exactly what you talk about. And I think that runs right the way through our parliamentary system, right the way through our education system, and actually into our health system as well, because it's about hierarchy and it's about control. And quite frankly, just as an aside, if the Queen wanted to stand for head of state, I wouldn't object. If Prince Charles wanted to stand for head of state, I wouldn't object. I wouldn't vote for either of them, but they should at least be entitled to have a go
and
then at least let the democratic will of the people preside. And that goes back to the point about Edward Bernays, who, of course, invented or was seen to invent, some people a bit fussy on that subject, PR, because he didn't trust the democratic will of the people. So it was established as a form of control. Anyway, back to your question. There am I, sitting in Chequers with David and Sam Cam, having a conversation about what to do. I think as a leader, you have to be brave to change the system. Dan Kieran, my publisher, the CEO of Unbound, says, I wake up every day and think, how do I disrupt myself? I don't think David Cameron has that thought. You know, I think the thought about politicians is, I'm an elected leader, how do I stay elected? And yes, there are some people who are great public servants, and there are some people who are in it just for power. And most politicians, I guess, are a mixture of both. And we see extremes elsewhere where they are just power crazed or policy crazed. I think it's an interesting question. But I think that the advice to David Cameron would be, disrupt yourself, change the system, have the balls to change the system, have the courage. And I think a lot of trust comes out of courage, goes back to fundamental Aristotelian principles, have the courage to recognise that this system does not serve Britain. And it's not just about proportional representation, it's about the style of leadership. You know, it's about the reform of the upper house. We have 830 people, I think it's probably more now, of basically political hangers-on mostly, and this ridiculous rump of hereditaries that was set in there as a compromise. And in fact, my only real issue, I think actually Blair's failure to reform the constitution was actually far more damaging to long-term health of this country than his war in Iraq. And again, I've gone on record saying that, and I'm happy to defend that for the people now write to me and go, you know, I'm just some sort of warmonger Blairite, which I've had from a few people in the past. So I think it's about the courage and the vision to change the system, to disrupt yourself, to form new coalitions. I think that we have to find common ground across the political spectrum. So if people believe in mutualisation, that shouldn't be the preserve of the Labour Party alone, just because the Rochdale Pioneers went on to form the bedrock of the Labour Party. If some people believe in home ownership, that shouldn't just be the preserve of the Tories. I mean, it's interesting, you know, we're recording this after David Cameron's speech, and, you know, he talks about the right to buy and everything. And, of course, what he's doing is making it very clear political positioning versus Labour's rented society versus his ownership society. You can see that sort of polarity emerging as an ideological point. And that's fine if it's an ideological point. Call it an ideological point. Don't make it necessarily just a policy point if you can't substantiate it. So I think there needs to be a much greater honesty in politics. I think there needs to be more coalitions in politics. I'd like to see, the phrase I use in the book is the danger. I'd like to see a thousand flowers bloom. I'd like to see much more multilateralism and much more sort of distinction between the parties that allow people to coalesce on different issues. The problem is if you get the UKIP reference, you end up with a thousand Godfrey blooms. Rather than a thousand flower blooms, and that can be problematic. But I think it does start with the upper chamber. I'd like to see an upper chamber that, you know, Germany has, I think, 64 members of its upper chamber. The United States, which is a damn sight bigger than we are, has 100 people in its upper chamber, and we have 800 people. And I'd like to see it represented with trade unionists, with nurses, with firemen, with teachers, with school children, and just to really annoy David Cameron, with prisoners as well. All these people have rights.
I give prisoners the vote. They're citizens. Yeah.
Well, they did have the vote until the Conservative government took it away. But we have to have a truly representative democracy. In the same way that I argue in business, people should be accountable to crowds. It should be no difference in Parliament. And if we're to have an upper chamber that properly holds the elected to account, then that's where reform has to start. So I think there are some very brave decisions that very few politicians would ever be prepared to make. If Cameron wants this, as he said today, this to be the decade of the decade when change happened, or whatever, or we returned to a better way, then he has to start in a way with constitutional reform, with leadership reform, with political party reform, and to accept that what has gone on in the past is just not the way that we need to progress in the future.
Final question in two parts: are you pleased with the impact that your book has made so far, and what's next for you personally?
I'd quite like to see United win the Champions League. That'd be quite nice, personally.
No chance.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. It's interesting. I was in a very privileged position to write the book. Obviously, I'd had a successful career in the communications sector, and I was very lucky for the 8 years that I spent at Edelman. I learned a huge amount, and I was always free to express my views, which I'll be eternally grateful, including one famous anecdote when someone said on a global conference call, "I'm not having you bring fucking socialism to this firm." So that maybe that will be my legacy. But I was very lucky because I was financially secure enough to walk away from a very highly paid and highly respected job and just to spend time walking around thinking about stuff. And one of the things that I've learned over the 18 months, 2 years I've been doing this is that bad economics subjugates good thinking. Mm. There are loads of people who share my passion, my views, for what I've been arguing for, but can't leave their jobs because they've got mortgages to pay. You know, I was in a very privileged position that I didn't have a mortgage to pay, or not a very big one, and that I could walk away and just think and write.
You could literally afford to do this.
Yeah, well, I mean, it meant not necessarily living in the style to which I'd grown accustomed, but it meant that I didn't have to worry for a period of time. Listen, I'm working and I'm working very hard. I'm probably working harder now than I'm a sad, lonely workaholic at the best of times.
So am I, sadly. But what's next for you?
So, but in answer to your question, am I pleased about the impact? Then I'll come on to the what's next. I didn't set out to do anything more than start a conversation. So I had no... people are sad that I didn't sort of settle scores in the book, but I didn't really have any scores to settle. I was asked by Matthew Gwyther when he interviewed for Management Today if I've already regretted stuff. And sure, there are little lies that I told in the 80s and 90s. I'm very proud of the fact that I made up 8 out of 10 women wear the wrong size bra. Mm-hmm. There are little white lies I told, and I wasn't a particularly good manager or leader until the last 10 years of my career. I think I made lots of tragic mistakes there, but I'd like to think that that I learned from them. So all I wanted to do was to start a conversation. I'm very pleased that conversation started. I'm a bit saddened by some of the Luddites that took against it. A lot of people, my favourite one was the person who said, I haven't read Phillips's book and I disagree with everything he says, which I thought was just classic.
Self-evidently reveals that they don't know what they're talking about.
And too many people have obsessed about the PR part of it rather than the trust part of it. And as people who've read through the book, yourself included, will know that it's much more about a book about business, society and leadership. But I didn't feel that I had the credibility to just say, right, you know, I'm going to write about a book about business, society and leadership, because all my experience, all my business experience was in PR and communications. The most gratifying part of the book has been the number of, I hesitate to say young people because that sounds terribly patronising, but people of different generations who've written to me and said, thank you. Thank you for saying it, because, you know, we see what you see, and yet we never thought anyone in your position would say it and feel it the way that we want to say it and where we feel it. And, of course, we can't really say it now to our bosses, but you know, we're with you all the way. And if that provokes a different conversation and different way of doing it, doing things, that's great. And interesting, hat tip to Colin Burns, CEO of Weber Shandwick, EMEA, who starts off by being very angry with me in social media and now gives a copy of my book to every new person starting at Weber Shandwick, or so he says. I haven't seen the sales go up that much, but maybe he's not employing that many people.
Maybe he's just photocopying it.
But I think that in that sense, people realise it is actually, it's not there to settle scores, it's not there to make noise, it's certainly not there to make money. I would have made a lot more money by staying at Edelman. It is there to start a conversation. And I suppose that ends the thing about both what for me next and also am I pleased with the impact this had. The work that I'm doing, both as a consultant and with my colleagues at Jericho, and we're now working with a whole bunch of C-suite people, really. Not just CEOs, but HR directors and finance directors and marketing directors to help make the world a better place bit by bit in business. And we're working with, you know, FTSE 100, Fortune 100, Fortune 500 companies on really serious programs that have a bit of everything that we talk about in the book. And that's not because I've gone out and sold to them and used the book as a sales tool. What we've done is put a piece of thinking out there and try to start a conversation. And people realize there's something in it. There's something in the fact that trust is not a message, it's an outcome. There's something in the fact that we have to move to a world where trust is based on actions, not words. We have to recognize that there is chaos, and rather than flee it because it's not convenient to sell to, if you're a consultancy, to embrace it. We have to learn to love citizen crowds. We have to take to the social dance floor and actually be sort of properly animated in the conversation, not sort of sterile sort of participants within it. We can be the media ourselves and enjoy being the media. And you see lots of big corporations that do that. And above all, we have to have radical honesty and radical transparency at the heart of what we do, because without that, the communications industry really is doomed.
Robert, if you're one of the four horsemen of the PR apocalypse, then, you know, I welcome what you're doing. I think it's much needed. I hugely enjoyed your book, and I'd be delighted to, you know, help publicise this conversation, because, like, as many people as possible can take place. It's a very important debate to be had. Thank you ever so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me on.
A Big Things Media production. Big Things!